Hello, everybody. Thanks for tuning in today. We're going to be talking a little bit today about some C++ and DirectX game development. My name is Mickey McDonald. I'm an indie game developer and Microsoft technological evangelist. I spend most of my days making up game templates and examples to show you guys. You know, I've worked with a lot of different platforms, including Windows 8, 8.1, you know, the Xbox 360, Windows Phone. You know, I get the chance to speak at a lot of industry events, so I get to share the knowledge that way. And yeah, that's a little bit about me. You can follow me at Twitter at Scruffy Fern. Check the spelling on that. I spell Fern a little differently than most people do. with me today, I've got Brian.
Hey, everybody. Spend most of my time programming to all hours of the night. I'm a software engineer and game developer. I'm also an instructor at Trias College in Canada. And basically just spend my time making video games, playing video games, researching as much as possible. You know, research is important. And I've worked with most of the major publishers over my 12 years in the gaming industry so far. I've worked with Activision Blizzard, Sega, THQ, Microsoft, all kinds of companies. And I spend most of my time instructing nowadays because it's fun to just work with other students, work with younger guys looking to get into the industry and sort of bring up the next generation of game developers. So that's why I moved into that and sort of out of the AAA industry, and that's what I spend most of my time doing nowadays. So today what we're going to do, we're going to go over C++, DirectX, really from the bare bones. We're going to break it down as much as possible, try to give you an easy way into going down this kind of development path. We're going to look at a little introduction first, getting started. It's a little early in the morning for some hardcore coding, so we're going to talk a little bit more about what you need to get started, the process you go through, and then we're going to move to what DirectX can do and creating the main game loop, very important part of your game, obviously. It runs everything. Then we'll move on to other topics such as creating, texturing, and moving objects, talking about state machines, how to build your game in a nice, easy-to-control manner to know where it is and what stage it's at all the way through. Capturing user input will be another module we'll do, obviously very important. We're going to look at a couple of different devices for capturing input, not just mouse and keyboard or touch displays. We're also going to get the controller in there and sort of bring it all together and show you how to manage all of those inputs sort of in a friendly game manner. And then we're going to move on to physics and collision detection and just explore a couple little topics in there, as well as then moving on to AI and some other features we need in our game. So from that, that'll be all we're pretty much going to cover today. And why not get started? So the target audience for today, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, sure. So we're basically trying to target this towards the students, the beginners, the indie developers, right? Those with a desire to really, you know, expand their knowledge of game development and learn the ins and outs of DirectX. We're not expecting you to know too much about DirectX. We're expecting you to have a little bit of basic knowledge around C++ and a little bit about Visual Studio. That'll definitely help. We're also expecting you've had a little bit of experience with Windows 8 and 8.1. You understand the interface and some of the features available to you that way. We also expect you to have a little bit of linear algebra and 3D coordinate systems knowledge. That's going to go a long way when you're working with DirectX, that's for sure. Yeah, the requirements is obviously you got to have that drive to make your own game. And we suggest you have some snacks and beverages on hand. This is going to be a little bit of time, so you know, you want to make sure you have something to munch on while we're chatting with you.
All right, so what about the MVA community? I mean, a lot of people already know.
Yeah, so, yeah, I'm sure a lot of you guys already know because you're here watching us. But if you haven't already, make sure you join up with the MVA community. It's tailored for, you know, ID pros and developers like us. We've got over 1 million registers already, which is pretty impressive. You know, it's up to date with the newest content and everything, so you can definitely check that out. While you're watching us, you're actually going to earn some points. You get 50 MVA points for watching us. The MVA voucher code's right there. It's Intro DirectX. So go ahead, click that link if you get the chance, and sign up that way.
All right, so that brings us into our first module, Introduction and Getting Started, and sort of what we're going to cover in this module this morning. We're going to look at the goals for the day. We're going to prepare to make a game. We're going to talk about how to sort of know your audience, make sure you have that clear understanding of who you want this game to be for and who you want to bring it to in the audience or sell it to and things like that. And then we're going to talk about picking the right tools for that kind of job, what you need to consider, what best fits the gameplay you're going to be working on or the system you want to roll it out for and so on. And then we're going to move into really what you need to start this demo as well as other things like that. And then verifying that we have everything running, we're ready to go, and we're going to take a quick look at a couple of new features in Visual Studios 2013 that'll help you do this development process. All right, so first off, the goals for the day. We're going to examine the process of preparing to make that game. We're going to create a C++ game for Windows Store using DirectX. That's our major goal for today, pretty much. And we're going to discuss common structures and patterns, implementations that are used when developing video games across the industry, whether you're indie or AAA. A lot of these things are sort of the backbone of how we build games, how we put it together. So we're going to look at those. And they'll pop up throughout all of the different sections. There's not just one section on that. And we're going to hopefully increase everybody's technical knowledge about threads, state machines, polymorphism, inheritance, other topics that are going to, again, just pop up throughout the day. And then at the end, we're going to have a couple of resources for you to continue your learning, somewhere to step on from here, move on with this game, bulk it out a little more, add your own flair to it, your own touch to it, experiment with it, and things like that. And ultimately, hopefully, have some fun while we're at it. So the preparing to make a game stage. Early on, there's really two main approaches most people will work with. Either they have this great idea, they've been mulling it around in their head for years. They finally have all the tools at their disposal, they've got some time, they're going to detail it, lay it all out, write it all out in paper, prototype it, and then really start to get into trying to create it. And that's fine, that's a great way to do it, especially when you know exactly what you want to do. Other times, the other approach usually is that you just want to do something. I don't know, you have a week off, Christmas vacation's coming up for a lot of people, those kinds of things. We want to pick a main mechanic and a theme usually, and then develop around that, experiment with it, play with it a little, and just sort of see what comes out of that idea, the one little idea you started with, and just go wherever it takes you. That can really move you into an area of game development where it doesn't feel as structured. It's just everything's flowing. You take the path of least resistance. Some people call it extreme programming. They don't worry about tomorrow or the next day or what they're going to have to deal with. They just take the simplest and easiest approach, hammer it out now, see where it goes. If you like it, you keep it. If you don't, you cut it and you keep going on. And that can make great, fun, entertaining little games that are perfectly suitable to roll out. There are obviously some other approaches out there. You could do a satire of other games, well-known ones, make fun of them, make fun of whole genres, sort of. We see that a lot lately going into different indie markets and that. People are just like, oh, I want to make a spoof of all the horror games that I used to know and love, or all the platformer games, and so on. You could revive an old genre that's being neglected right now. That's another great approach. There's been a lot of popular platformers come back in. The 8-bit era is sort of coming in. So instead of really bringing back a genre, they're just making all the art in all the genres where we wouldn't have seen 8-bit, now 8-bit. I'm sure you can think of a ton of, games that fit that profile. And another approach is just to learn from others what they've done well, clean up what they did poorly, and move on from there. That's a great way for people to do case studies. That's effectively what you're doing. You just pick a game, maybe in a genre you don't normally play or you haven't programmed for before, just to give yourself some more breadth in what you can do. You take it, you analyze it, try to pick out what went wrong, what was great, try to keep those, try to fill in any holes that you remove from taking out the parts that didn't work so well. And then finally, you could always just make a story and art game. People that usually do that want to show off their art skills or their creativity or something like that. And it's fine. We haven't seen them really take off all that much, but it serves a purpose. Some people really love them. It's more of a niche market, but you're doing it to accent your skills more than actually trying to create the next blockbuster. And that's absolutely fine. It's a great way to do different kinds of games. So, of course, you're probably going to need a team. So it could be other students, could be other professionals that you know from other industries. Don't be afraid to share your game ideas with people. Okay, go to events, mashups, programming, game-a-thons, weekends, things like that. Share your ideas with people. A lot of people, when they start out, they're afraid that, you know, oh, if I tell somebody, they're going to take my idea and run with it, and I'm not going to get any credit. Don't worry about that. They have their own ideas. Okay, you're going to come up with a new idea pretty quickly anyways if you tried. Okay, it might feel like it's the best idea ever, but it might not be, and you'll find that out when you start programming. So don't be afraid to share with people. You want to find people that are interested in that idea. They might be like, oh, that sounds great. You know, do you need an artist? Do you need another developer? And so on. And you really want to look for those people with a like mind that are going to help you initially really grow that idea and build it out. At the same time, you want to look for some people that offer strengths to cover your weaknesses. Okay. If you're all great at, you know, 3D math and graphics and programming and that, but you have nobody that can draw, your game is sort of limited in certain aspects. So you might want to find somebody else that can bring those other sides to the coin and complete your whole project. So you should also find still the people with talents that lie within your area, especially if that area happens to be what your game needs to bulk out. Having three or four programmers is great if you're going to have a lot of structured moments that you need to hand code every single one. Typically, you don't want to do that with a game, but those are the kinds of people you may need if that's what you need in that development process. Don't forget someone that knows businessing or marketing or something. If you're going to take this all the way, you're going to publish it, you're going to get out there in the world, and you're going to be a huge success, you probably want somebody that you know you can trust, that you've worked with before, that knows a little bit of the marketing, businessing side. Because a lot of smaller companies really run into that issue. They think they can do it all themselves. They get out there, they're great programmers, they're great artists, they're great game designers. They know nothing about marketing, and that's where the slip-up occurs. So try to keep that in mind when you're looking for your team of individuals to bring together. Of course, you could always fly solo. There's no meetings, there's no extra overhead. Whatever idea you like, you can put in there and you can get going. It's a great way to start things up or to prototype things. Different game elements, different mechanics. There's no pressure, it's just you. But then again, some people don't have the best dedication or drive. They get distracted by whatever games came out this week, and the research takes over their time, and not so much developing happens. So always try to make sure you have that extra person to give you that nudge, even if they're not necessarily in your team, somebody that can keep you on track if that's what you need. Okay, it is an important part. So I do. Those are the two ways to, you know, sort of form your team and get started. Once you have that team, you have your idea, you really need to frame who is this game for. Okay, you need to consider your audience. You want to, sometimes a lot of companies or even individuals, I myself will do this, if I'm going to make a game that's for a niche group, you need to know that specific profile of person that looks for those kinds of games. And sometimes the best way to do that is to build a persona or a profile for them. Write it down or type it up, whatever. Get it structured. Be detail-oriented. You know, what kind of games do they like? What ones are they playing right now? And again, this is all subjective and hypothetical, but later on when you're developing something and you run into a problem, you can look back and be like, well, here's our two solutions. Which one should we pick? You look at your persona, you read over the details, evaluate a little bit, and be like, well, this persona would have liked this decision. So that's what we're going to go with. Sometimes that's a great aid. So you want things like their age, their gender, your target audience, all those details. How much time do they play during a day? How much time do they play during a week? Right? Do they prefer co-op, single player, multiplayer, and so on, versus MMOs, anything like that? Those kinds of details are what you're looking for in that audience profile. And then whenever you have a question, like I said, about your game, you can go back to that, refer to that, and it helps you maintain your focus on the goals as the years pass by. In terms of platforms, which platforms are you making this game for? What differences are there between the selected platforms that you've chosen? We need to consider, are there control schemes differences? A lot of, I've been in situations where we've designed a whole game And then somebody goes, oh, but we're also going to make it for the tablet or a phone. And the simplest things will slip by the entire design, thinking they can just, for example, scale the screen size and everything will have enough room to play with. We'll have enough control space and so on. But you don't anymore, maybe on the smaller screen or a different format. Maybe it's stretched a little bit more and so on. So those are important things to consider. Detail them if you are going to hit multiple platforms, or you are going to roll out in different stores. You need to consider all those things ahead of time. Is there a large performance difference? Is usually the key one that everybody does consider. Oh, I'm gonna run on the new Xbox One, but at the same time, I want it to run on my phone. Those kinds of performance differences are going to be key to remember. Most people get that one. They usually forget the screen format, the touch controls versus a controller, and so on. It seems obvious, but you'll be surprised at what slips people's minds if you don't sort of write it down and actually consider it and think about it actively. Now, what hoops do you have to jump through on these different platforms? Some of them have certification requirements to get into the store and get it out there. Other ones have either none or a completely different set. If you're going to release it on the web, there's no real certification requirements. You just need to get it out there and away you go. But most of the phone vendors and other digital stores, you do have something that you have to meet requirement-wise. And that's important to try to do a little research into, make sure you're going to know the differences and that you can hit all of those differences. Also, what will those platforms be like when your projected game will release? Is the hardware going to change by then? Is it going to be a new console generation? Is it going to take you 10 years to make this game? You're going to have to be doing some crazy future planning. Hopefully it won't take you that long. That'd be a really long game to develop. You might have some issues doing that. But it's just something to keep in mind. Sometimes it plays a role. A lot of the smaller games, obviously we're not going to have those kinds of issues. Now, picking the right tool, also important. Should you use a game engine, middleware? Are you going to outsource some of the artwork and so on? You really just want to pick what fits your specific game's needs and goals. Some people will set out and do it the opposite way. What tools are available for me? What can I develop with? They'll just pick those, and then they'll develop a game that fits those tools. And that's perfectly fine. That's a great way to do it. At least you know you're going to be able to accomplish whatever you set out to do. But a lot of the times, it's usually you have an idea, or you've been handed out a contract or something where they want you to make a game a certain way, and you're going to need to find the tools that fit that. So can a certain tool fill an area or skill that your team is lacking? That's another great place for tools. For example, organizational skills. A lot of people lack organizational skills. And there are tools out there to help you with that, keep you on track. Okay, you can get Gantt charts and so on to keep everybody's tasks lined up. You know when everybody's going to complete the different tasks and move forward together as a team. So there are great tools for soft skills. There's all the tools we actually need that we're going to talk about today for doing the hard skills and the actual development as well. And using someone else's system, whether it's code that you've downloaded from the internet, or an engine, you have to realize that it was designed to do something else in a particular way or a particular fashion for whatever they were solving. And you're going to need to adapt that. You're going to spend time spinning your wheels trying to figure out why they optimize certain things certain ways. You're probably going to have to dig in and rewrite certain chunks of it. And if you don't have access to those chunks of source code, you're going to be caught and not really have anywhere to go at that point. You're going to have to change your game to meet theirs. So you got to be wary of bringing in other people's tool sets, especially when you don't have that low-level access, unless you, again, are building your game to the tools as opposed to the other way around. So another thing to consider, you do have other people working with you. Are these tools, are other people in your team comfortable working with these tools? Do they have experience with it? Or is everybody going to have a learning curve, picking this up, running with it, and trying to make something with it? You might want to pad out your planning initially for how long certain things are going to take you to accomplish in the early stages because of the tool learning curve that everybody on your team is going to experience. And then finally, what are your deployment strategies and how are you going to manage your code and assets with multiple people? There are tools that help you with those kinds of situations. There are tools that plug right in with Visual Studio as well to help you manage, for example, your source code and push it up to a central repository that everybody on your team can grab. And you'll want to look at those tools and sort of see how they fit together, where can you get them, and wrap it all up. Deployment, same kind of idea. How are you going to build an executable, or how do you push to the different platforms that you're going to need? You're going to have to find tools that support that and make sure that everything works out really well. Bug tracking or getting responses from users when your game does crash is another kind of tool that you can look into. You can bind them right into your code so that when, unfortunately, somebody hard locks your game and it freezes up and crashes, it sends you back a little bug report on where it did, what possible data there was, so that you can fix it and get it back out there. Those are sort of the larger stages that the bigger companies are more concerned with. A lot of the indie developers don't necessarily have that in their little Windows Store's apps and things like that. If it crashes, you know, they hear about it on their forums and they try to fix it up that way. But there are tools out there, and that's what I want to make you aware of, that you can get and you can build into your systems to sort of handle that kind of situation. So, Mickey, what do we need to really get started?
Well, I was going to say, actually, that was a really good overview of, like, you know, planning out a game. You know, it does take a lot of time. There's a lot to consider, obviously. But if you go through those steps and you take that time, down the road, you're going to save yourself a lot of time, right? So, yeah, definitely... planning is a very big part of making video games. You know, a lot of us out there can code really well, but a lot of us have a little trouble planning. So, yeah, take the extra bit of time and definitely go through those steps. That was a really good overview, though. Yeah, so, thinking of tools we're going to need for today, obviously you're going to need a copy of Windows 8, 8.1. There's some numerous ways you can get your hands on that. If you can't get a copy, you can also get a trial. Copy for this. If you're a Mac user, there's ways of getting that on your hardware as well. You can look at something like Parallels or using a virtual machine. You're going to need a copy of Visual Studio 2013. Ultimate or Premium are the best ways to go, I find. Anyway, they got all the bells and whistles for us to play around with. But if you only got access to Express, that's going to work fine for you as well. And yeah, that's about it. That's all you're really going to need to get started today with us. And yeah. So what do you think? You want to jump in and show them a little bit of demo and what it takes to get a DirectX game up and going?
Yeah, we can do that. So let me just jump out of here. There we go. Sorry, it takes a second to switch over here. All right, so if we have everything set up, if you have everything installed, wrong button there, you could just... To verify everything's in place, that you have everything you need, again, Visual Studio's 2013, when you install it and set it up, it has all the packages you will need for DirectX. There's no extra installing SDK pieces or other puzzle pieces that you need to find to bring in. So you could just fire up the Visual Studios here, and I'm in C# by accident. There we go, C++. And what are we going to run here? Let's go with... does that one look good? There we go. Let's do this one here. So one way to test, you can do the Windows Phone Direct3D app native only and just create one of those. And effectively, if everything's good, you should be able to just compile that and run that on its own right away. It'll pop up the emulator, and that may take a few seconds depending on your system once it's done compiling. But in the end, what we should get here, just to verify that, you know, we have everything we need for today's setup, is we'll see a nice little multicolored cube that you can spin around and manipulate on the emulator itself. So I'm just going to take a minute to load here. Oh, coming online. There we go. And it's got to install the application on our emulator.
First time always takes a little bit, and then, afterwards.
There it is. So if you can do that, then you pretty much know you have everything you need to move forward with all the stuff we're going to do today. This is running in DirectX 3D, and that's about it. So it's a pretty simple little app. We will actually refer to this one again later on today as we go through different modules, just to show you how they pull this off, how they do the little different color bending between the corners, how to build a cube, and so on, and then we'll show you how we do it in our actual demo app as well. which if I pop that out, oh, didn't mean to kill it. There we go. I'll flip back over here.
So yeah, if you're been using DirectX for a while and you're probably kind of shocked. I was shocked when I first saw that, how easy it was to get a DirectX app up and running.
Yep.
You know, back in the day, it used to take us, what, a weekend just to get a window to pop open? And,
yep.
You know, you'd be sitting there writing the engine all weekend, and then finally you get to dig into the game code. So, yeah, definitely having that template is a huge bonus now.
Yeah, especially for beginners, just seeing how to do some primitive geometry and stepping through. There's so many topics you really need to get to a point like this, where you actually have a little pop-up menu that, you know, you can tap on or click on. We got a little camera system here, so I can jiggle it around. I'm the guy on the right at the moment. And you can move these little sumo cubes around, try to push each other, try to get them out of the area. And this is effectively the demo game that we're going to be looking at and going over. If I can get them off, there we go. Then we win, we tap it, and we get back into playing again. So that's what we're going to look at today, really. So again, we're going to use our cube that we just saw. We're going to look at how to build that cube out. We're going to place it in here. We're going to get this little cylinder for our playmat, and then we'll work with physics, AI, and all those other things. So this is effectively our end goal for today, is to try to get to this point where we can try to do... Oh, he's fighting me. He's fighting me good there. Come on. And we'll be able to play this, and if he beats me, tosses me out of the ring there, then we lose. So that's what our end goal is, really. And that's where we want to get to. All right, so just let me pop back over to here so we can continue on.
Yeah, since we're talking about Visual Studio, I'll take over for a second and
Sure. Just
you know, have a quick chat about some of the cool new features available in Visual Studio. So yeah, in Visual Studio 2013, they've added a lot of helpful things for us, and I thought I'd take just a couple of minutes and step through a few of them for you. So first up, you know, if you're a C# developer, you've probably seen this before, but just recently in 2013, they released the Just My Code for C++. JMC feature, as it's known as in the short form, is basically there to help the users focus on their code. So you're not seeing all the other library code and stuff like that when you set your breakpoints, which is very helpful. You know, I've done it numerous times. I've stepped, you know, into a function, and suddenly I'm getting thrown into a Windows library, and I got to step out and then step back in, and you know that gets kind of tedious after a while. So this is a really good feature, you know, especially when you're doing the late night coding and you're trying to figure out why that bug's there, and you're you know, pulling your hair out, just want to figure it out. So yeah, it's a really cool feature, and it's really easy to use. That's the one thing that I really liked about it. You know, getting started here, we got a little basics sample for you. If you just went and created a new Windows 32 console application in Visual Studio and had JMC turned off, if you set a breakpoint right at the very beginning, you'd see your stack, your call stack right there. And as you can see, there's a lot in that call stack. And that's just setting a breakpoint on a default, you know, Win32 console application. So, you know, that's a lot of things to step through. But if you were to turn on the JMC feature, you'll notice right there my call stack is shrunk down to one line. So that's really helpful in my eyes, for sure. And, you know, the Just My Code doesn't apply to just the call stack window. It also, you know, has some benefits for your thread windows. So as you can see down there at the bottom, if you've got it turned on, you know, you get a really nice-looking thread window. You don't have a bunch of threads open and have to step through all those. So, yeah, it's a really neat feature. Again, turning it on and off is just a breeze. If you were in your external code window there, if you're in your call stack window and you right-click, it'll pop up a context menu, and you'll see right there that you got Show External Code. If you click that, it'll allow you to have it. If you don't have it clicked, you're going to have all your code hidden. So, yeah, that's a really cool feature. Definitely worth taking a look at. Again, yeah, if you got it turned off there, it'll show any stacks that aren't yours in gray. If it is yours, it'll pop up in dark black. So you still get to see that,
right.
You know, so you're not missing at all, but it's not, you know, your focal point, so to speak. If you want to turn it on and off completely, you can actually just go right into the Tools and Options settings. Scroll down there, and you'll find a setting that says Enable Just My Code. You click that, and it turns it on, and away you go.
Oh, I like this tool.
Yeah, this is a pretty good tool, especially for us mobile devs, right? You're building games on the tablets, and you want to make sure that you know how much energy you're sucking out of these tablets, right? You don't want someone to get to play your game for 5 minutes and suddenly, boom, they got to plug it in, right? So this tool's been a lot of help for us, you know, doing development like that. Again, very easy to use. All you have to do is go in here and set it up. So you set up your app, you go into your diagnostic hub page. You look for the select energy consumption. When you click start, it'll launch your application and it'll fire this up along with the profiling. Then you're just going to go back into your application. You're going to run through it, you know, maybe play the game, play a few levels, stuff like that. Try to find the most intensive parts of your game, really, right? Because that's what you want to test.
So the gameplay. I got to play the gameplay over and over again.
Okay, yeah,
I can do that.
That's the fun part of development, right?
That's right.
So then, when you're done that, you can actually just go ahead and click stop. Once you click stop collection, you're going to see a profile window pop up here. And it'll actually show you a nice little report detailing, you know, how much energy you've sucked out of the tablet or mobile device, whatever it might be.
Right.
So yeah, it's definitely a good way to tell, you know, do I need to cut down on how many models I've got showing on the screen at once, or, you know, how many particle effects I've got running, whatever it might be. But yeah, it's definitely a fun tool to use for mobile
development. Stop using the flash as a particle effect on the phone.
Yeah.
You know, don't want to do that.
Yeah, that'll drain a little bit of battery. Oh, okay. Yeah. Another really good one, and this is something that a lot of you might be familiar with in its former name, the Team Foundation Service. So Visual Studio Online, which, like I said, was formerly known as Team Foundation Service, is the home for your project data in the cloud. So basically what this means is you can have your code stored up in the cloud and allow multiple users to work on it at the same time without having to set up an external program for that.
Right.
So, you know, for smaller teams, this is definitely a good way of going. You know, getting up and running is really, really quick with this. In fact, you basically just sign in and it sets you up automatically. You can configure a single server. The Visual Studio Online Basic is completely free for up to 5 users. So that's definitely a bonus. And it works with Git repos as well as other project hacking tools.
Right, and that's how we did this one.
We used Git so that we could work back and forth with this. So yeah, we took a advantage of this ourselves.
That's great.
So yeah, it's just a little bit about the new tools available for Visual Studio 2013. There's a lot more. You know, obviously I could have done a whole presentation on this alone, but yeah, definitely dig in there and check out some of those new tools. They'll save you some time and some headaches.
Yeah, we'll see a couple more when we get to shaders.
Yeah, exactly.
There's some neat ones that we can look at, and there's a model viewer in that. A lot of people don't realize that it's in there.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're doing game development, you can see a lot of those little extras just to be like, am I seeing what I think I'm seeing? Okay, yeah, the model's supposed to look like this, and that's what I see in game. So it helps to verify that. So there are a lot of new features that have been added to 2013 that are useful. And I've already shown you the quick little preview of the demo game, so we're not going to go through that again right now. But that's it for the first module. After that, we're going to get back in. We're going to look at DirectX. We're going to see, you know, what it's capable of, and then we'll move into sort of getting things started, get that main game loop running, and get our game up and going.
This sounds like a good time to take a break then. So what do you say we take a 10-minute break, and then we'll come back and we'll dig in a little deeper.
Right.